Code Review, a weekly web development podcast with your hosts Dylan Marsh and Brandon Timmish.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dylan Marsh.
And I'm Brandon Timmish, and this is The Code Review.
This week, we discuss our opinions on Vue, the Azure outage, and FinTech technology by BBVA.
Yeah. So I think starting off with Vue, that's kind of, the three big players in that arena right now are Angular, React, and Vue. And we personally prefer Vue. And I'm actually going to let Dylan kind of jump into some of the reasons for that. Gonna immediately pass it over.
Yeah, I mean, Angular's, I'm pretty sure it's still the largest in terms of like stars. I don't know how to really quantify that other than like how many people, you know, follow it on GitHub and stuff. But it's been around the longest. It's I don't know if saying it's the most mature is quite the right thing to say, but
it's been through so many different versions.
Yeah. So that's why I'm hesitant to say that specifically, but ultra popular. And to be fair, if you wanted to get a job in any of those frameworks, like there's more available jobs for full stack developers with Angular experience than there is with React. And there's more for React than there is for Vue.
Yeah.
But we love Vue because... And we're going to get into those reasons, but I just want to preface all this by saying, like, none of these are bad. All three are really great, and they have pros and cons to each, Vue included. And it's going to be interesting to see where all these frameworks continue to go. You know, React's continually upgrading and going through new things like React hooks, and Vue has a V3 coming out where they're addressing a bunch of maybe not issues, but they're definitely making it a lot better. And Angular's gone through, you know, various revisions. I think it's on Angular 4 now, maybe 5 for all I know.
I don't know.
Iterating pretty quickly, but
I don't really keep up with it enough.
You know, I love Vue because of some of the patterns that they've adopted and, you know, are bringing to fruition, like the single file components. I'm a huge fan of. I like using, you know, just plain old HTML, and I use SCSS. Right, all in a single file and not having to worry about JSX or anything like that.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's something that I really like as well. How you were saying the single component files, that's actually a big reason why I personally like Vue as well. It's just, especially with styling, the really cool thing about Vue is that you can have your HTML, your JavaScript, and your CSS, SAS, SCSS, whatever, all in the same file. And specifically for the styling, you can set that to be scoped. So in your main app file, you can have all your global styling. And then for each component, you can just scope it to that specific component. So you don't have to worry about, you know, things bleeding over into other components. And it just makes your life a whole lot easier.
Yeah, I mean, the whole advent of components changed the game across all these frameworks. And they're all pretty much like going after the same problem, just the different flavors. So it's not like you can't achieve doing that with like Angular or React, but the way Vue's conventions are for doing that is just my personal preference. It's like a totally subjective thing.
Yeah.
So without getting into like performance benchmarks or how many packages are available for it and who's supporting it and who has courses on what, it's just honestly came down to personal preference.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, kind of a comparison between React and Vue. Another thing is like, so in React, if you need to iterate through some data to populate a list in your HTML, you know, you'll have to write out like for, you'll have your parentheses and, you know, var, whatever in here. But in Vue, it's really nice because they have attributes like V4 and like VIF. So all these things are embedded in the HTML. And it just, to me, it looks like a lot cleaner, more readable code.
Yeah. And that's a hot topic because, you know, some people don't like that whole like directive usage. They don't like quote unquote putting mud in their markup. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Which
it does. But if you look at Vue, it kind of took the best of both worlds, like that whole concept of directives and stuff from Angular, which is just my opinion. It kind of feels Angular-esque and it also feels a little bit like React. It just seems like the best of both worlds to me. But all three of these packages are super performant. And like if you want to use either React or Vue, if you want to do server-side rendering, like you have Next or Nuxt. Like if you want to do, you know, state management, they both have like pretty much the same libraries available for both.
Yeah.
But where React really has it is in React Native.
Yeah.
Where you can use a CLI tool and build this cool little project up in just a few seconds and have that mobile support. Whereas Vue guys are and gals are kind of using Cordova primarily, but you know, there's native script and stuff now, and Vue 3 sounds like they're going to solve some of those problems, hopefully. But
yeah, I mean, that's definitely, yeah, that's a little bit of a pain point, but I mean, I think we can definitely agree with all three of these. Like, it's a great time to be a developer. Like, these are all great frameworks to be able to work with. And it, I mean, the amount of work that goes in, it makes your life so much easier to code things out and get it working properly.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if that's our biggest issue is deciding which one of these amazing frameworks to use. And there's more, you know, there's not just those three. It's just the three most notable at the moment that everyone talks about. But
yeah,
React's been getting a ton of love, especially on podcasts and like courses and Twitter. It's pretty much everywhere. But Vue's creeping up. It's getting pretty popular. And a lot of people thought that, you know, React would surpass Angular and Vue would kind of just die. But I do think, I don't know, the reward for who's the top, you know, like single page app framework like that is still up in the air. Like, it really could be any of them, because, you know, Angular could go through an iteration that just is killer and just takes the best of everything and pairs it with its maturity.
Yeah. And I mean, for all we know, too, they could all have their own place in the market. They could each find their own niche. And depending on what kind of apps you're building or what you want to accomplish, like, they could all potentially be, you know, heavy hitters for whatever their specialty is.
Yeah. And I think, you know, native features coming to like JavaScript and CSS and stuff may, and just the web in general, maybe render some of these things obsolete in the future. But you're definitely going to see concepts from all of them borrowed into native implementations of next versions of JavaScript and CSS and stuff, which is going to be pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's totally a kind of an opinion piece, and I don't want to get into like feature v feature and benchmarks, like I said, because I just think that that's been covered enough times. But I think all devs should come out and say, this is specifically why I use the framework that I use, because I think there's a lot of devs that are getting into this and are looking for the silver bullet shred of evidence that says I should use this versus something else. And I'm just telling you, like, unless you're doing something really hyper specific, there is no right or wrong answer for a lot of these things. Like, if you're just building some pretty generic things, and especially if you're just learning to learn, you know, you're not working on a specific project yet, so there's probably no wrong answer for it.
I mean, just development in general is always kind of a moving target, so it's hard to sometimes pin these things down, because for all we know, you know, if we started doing feature v feature, you know, in a year's time, it might have flipped, or, you know, it might not even matter anymore because of something.
We're trying to make evergreen content here. As much as we can. That makes sense. So you brought up the Azure outage.
Yeah.
And that was, so as of recording, it was yesterday, but that's May 2nd.
Yeah.
Azure had sounds like a bit of an outage.
Yeah. So I don't know, you know, if you personally use Microsoft Azure, or maybe you have a team that does, you may have had some issues with some of your apps functioning. I know Xbox Live, Office 365 were affected, and it sounds like it was due to a data migration. Azure was moving some of their legacy DNS systems to Azure DNS systems, and some of the stuff just wasn't set quite right. And so it was a DNS issue. There wasn't actually a service outage. It's just things couldn't find their way around. But
it might be worse, though, that it took like over an hour to figure out, like, I just wonder what it is. So I'm sure they have just thousands and thousands of DNS records to go back through. And all that was probably scripted. So,
And, you know, plus with it being, I mean, I don't know any developer that hears data migration and is like, yes, awesome, it's my time to shine. I mean, like, you know, some people might focus a little bit more on that, but usually when I'm in a room with a bunch of developers and you hear the words data migration, you just get a huge collective groan and like, oh no.
It's when your DevOps team starts maniacally grinning. I mean, I've been a part of a few migrations, and none of them, I think, have gone perfectly. Especially as, you know, when you work in a larger corporation and you're transitioning systems with lots of moving parts, on a smaller scale, like, I've been a part of a few smaller startup teams where we've had to like move a company's CRM. And that's like a nightmare of enough. You know what I mean? Like, we need all of our contacts perfectly formatted across these two incompatible systems. And some migrations are tough. DevOps is tough in general. But, you know, Azure is a pretty huge platform. It's like, you know, if Azure goes down or Google Cloud Services or AWS or something, it's got a huge widespread reach. So.
Yeah, because I remember a couple of years ago, I think AWS had an outage and like, I mean, everything, like all these, a lot of services run on AWS. Like I think Netflix went down and
The day the earth stood still.
You could just feel the panic from the world. Like, oh, my Netflix isn't working. And I mean, if these big companies, I mean, you know, data migrations can be stressful. And so if even a large company like that sometimes struggles with it, like, I mean, everybody, like Dylan was saying, I mean, it never necessarily goes perfectly.
And what's so silly is like when something like that specifically is impacted, like your DNS system, you know, it's like, well, you know, I could see people saying like, why don't we have like redundancy or backups? And it's like, well, this is what routes to everything. Like you can't load balance if it can't route to anywhere.
Yeah. So,
it's not like the server went down, like the thing that said, you know, told you where the servers are. It's a great way to think about it.
Yeah. And like you said too, with the number of DNS records they probably had to go through, like I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
And like that's, you know, I've done a few smaller migrations, which, you know, they have their own troubles as well. But I was working as a consultant and thankfully I wasn't in charge of anything. I was kind of shadowing an architect at the time because I was very, very new to the field. And we were going to be doing a data migration because a large company wanted to migrate all of their on-premise data into AWS. And the only thing about it is that they were churning out like tens of petabytes of information each year. And like it was compounding.
Yeah.
And because I think it was like some kind of like genetic information. And so, you know, that's a lot of stuff. And I just remember sitting there and like, thinking about how like I can't even comprehend the amount of data that you would have to worry about potentially messing up or losing or like.
Yeah, it is rough. And I mean, especially like, so I'm working with a client right now that funny enough wants to move from their just traditional like .NET, Microsoft SQL Server, Microsoft Server setup to Azure's new like cloud containers and their hosted databases. And it's a project we've just been like punting down the line because it's a lot. Like you have to go through, you know, a decade or more of business. And when like you're an SMB, a small to medium sized business, sometimes you do like a lot of custom stuff for clients and you like cloning databases and letting, you know what I mean? It's a lot. So it's not even just like the act of migration as much as it just requires like humans to coordinate and make plans and move and coordinate information.
Yeah.
It's not a technologically challenging proposition. Yeah. It's like a human issue, you know,
which just, I think, I mean, sometimes it just seems like those are the hardest problems though, when it's just, I mean, sometimes like, you know, I would almost prefer more technical challenge, but when it's like, you have to have a large number of people coordinate to get everything correct.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, it makes you like go back and like, I remember working, I worked at a large corporation and we used Confluence as like a knowledge base and we did like postmortems and like if we did a patch, we had to like write up what happened and documented everything. And it's because of that, you know what I mean? It's because like, well, there's a bunch of humans touching this stuff all the time. And like one day we're going to have to change it. We want to know what happened. And you may have gotten hit by a bus or fired or left a job or transferred, or, you know, this company could be bought by someone else. And it's just a lot to even contemplate. Yeah. So like next time you know, if you're like transitioning your own stuff or like moving to a new host, you know, think about that kind of stuff. Like, well, if I have all these DNS records and did I set up like a email campaign a while ago and my G Suite, like I know if you set up G Suite and you'll have like 12 MX records for no reason to go through like all the verification and Google gives you like 5 fallback MX records. So, you know, it's a lot to document and change over.
Yeah.
So it's easy to kind of point blame at them and be like, what the hell, Microsoft, you know, can't play the new COD or whatever.
Right now. Oh yeah, with Xbox Live. Yeah.
Man, such a pain in the ass. I totally sympathize.
Yeah. So if anybody listening is currently going through a data migration, we completely feel you. We're here for you.
Yeah, we want to hear about it too.
Yeah.
We want to hear how perfectly it's going for you.
Oh.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, we've been talking a lot about this whole fintech topic.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting to me. And I didn't know a whole lot about that term specifically, fintech, but I'm still kind of assuming it just means financial technology, right?
Yeah.
Just those two words.
There for a while, I thought it was like specifically like those that are like cranking out algorithms for like stock trading or something. I didn't even think about like...
I guess it's just like if you're writing software, tech in the financial space.
Yeah.
It's really that simple. But there's a bank, BBVA, and that's B as in boy. And it's just a BBVA Compass Bank, I believe is the full name.
Yeah.
And they have an open platform. So they've like, they're a bank. They're one of the top 25 largest banks in the US, I believe. And they've open sourced their API that runs their bank. So like, let that sit in for a minute. You can actually go right now to their website and sign up for an account and instantly get sandbox access to be able to create users their own bank accounts, all virtually, and provision them debit cards. And not just virtual cards, you can actually white label cards from Visa and mail it to them. So think about apps like Simple or Acorns, the investing app. These are fintech startups, and they're able to actually FDIC insure their users of their app and give them accounts and act like a bank. But what they really have is a banking partner who's given them some sort of an API.
Yeah.
So they're just app developers, but you know, the facade's that they're a bank, and that's not true. That's not actually how it works. So we figured this out recently, and it was pretty interesting.
Yeah. Especially because we figured out that the combination of having this open API through BBVA and you know, payment processing with Stripe and being able to link accounts with Plaid. Like, I mean, you can, if you know how to code, you can create your entire own like financial institution.
Yeah, definitely. So like using Plaid to actually fund your account. So imagine like I have my own bank account with, I'll say Chase because that's not my bank. But but if I, you know, joined a new digital bank through an app, I could just say like, hey, here's my Chase login and credentials. And it pulls my accounts up and I say, pull from my primary checking, $50. And that's what I want in this new digital bank account. You can do all that with like a few REST API calls. It's pretty impressive. And so I want to call out a few others. There's BBVA, which has this open platform. It's the only one that I found so far that allows you to join and get like sandbox access and start plugging away immediately. But then Stripe has their card issuing API, but it is in closed beta. It is invite only right now, but it looks like they're getting into the same space of being able to like make these, you know, basically bank accounts and then provision cards, like physical white labeled debit cards to customers that they can use at ATMs, get cash back, all this stuff.
Yeah.
And there's another one called Camber. So that's C-A-M-B-R. And they look like they're kind of leading the space in terms of what their API can do. But that's also closed. So I was curious. I called them like five times and left, you know, filled out their contact form. It was like, I'm just interested. I'm a developer. And a guy actually reached out to me and he ended up, you know, kind of, he was super nice, just told me all about like what they can do. And it turns out like, you know, they're really interested in working in like early stage series A or seed funding type companies. So you have to have some investment.
Yeah.
And the number he quoted was between 3 and 5 million. To specifically, you know, for them to be interested enough to work with you.
Yeah, so small change.
Yeah. Just a weekend withdrawal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no.
I guess the whole reasoning behind that is because they're not a bank. They have all the tech and they have a network nationally of banking partners. And then they basically like work with you to pair you up with the banking partner. And then they're like the technology connector between the two. So they like shop you around, and in order to do that, they'd like you have some funding so that, you know, these are good.
What was the network that you said it was?
So if I understand it correctly, Camber is the brainchild of two companies in a strategic partnership. And one is Stonecastle. And Stonecastle, from what I was reading about them, it sounds like they're a network of banks, right? So I think that's where the banking partners come from. Mm-hmm. And the other one was Q2.
Okay.
G2.
We'll have to check.
QT. Yeah. I don't know.
QT. No. We'll put it in the notes. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure the first one I said was right. But that's like the technology API connector side. And so between using their tech and Stone Castle's network of banks and like, you know, making this new entity Camber that kind of marries all this stuff together, they can take. So if you had this idea and you know, their API docs are open, so even though you can't get like test keys to play with it, you mm-hmm. could, you know, stub out the functionality of this app if you wanted to, and you know, get some seed funding. Although like 3 to 5, they said seed, but 3 to 5 million in seed funding for like a pre-revenue fintech startup may be common. I don't know, but it just seems like a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know. It seems like a
Series Although I mean, maybe fintech gets a little more love from investors.
I'm sure they do. But anyway, you know, you would do that and then use their API. But they have like some sort of proprietary measure to where they can ensure that you get the most interest and interchange fees because of this network of banks versus anyone else.
Which I guess some listening might not actually be completely familiar with some of that. I know we've talked a little bit and we've talked about how banks actually make money. Like a lot of people know, you know, they make interest off of the money that they have in their accounts and that people have, that they're holding for others. But you mentioned interchange fees, and I don't know, some people might be familiar with it, but it was a really interesting concept.
Yeah. And I wasn't familiar with, like, I mean, it makes sense that like they would have interest on the money that they're holding on your behalf, just like you have interest on your money in their savings account, except they just get more interest on your money than you do. But the interchange fees are cool. So when you swipe your card at your local bagel shop, your bagel shop owner pays a fee to accept your credit card or debit card payment. And that fee is typically like 2.9% and then in 30 cents per transaction or something like that. So a portion of that fee, which is called the interchange fee, will go to Visa or MasterCard, whoever's network your card's processing through. And then another portion of that percentage will go to the issuing bank of your card. So they actually make money on that interchange fee. The banks do. Mm-hmm. They make a lot of money on those interchange fees. And any other middlemen in between will take a portion of that as well. So like if I'm accepting cards in my bagel shop with, Stripe or Square, like those little card readers.
Yeah.
Everyone's kind of like dipping at this little percentage, but the merchant is the one who's eating that cost to have the privilege to accept a card.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was the whole point. So like the reason why people are getting into this fintech space and not charging for their apps, not charging setup fees for these accounts, and even offering cash back is because they are now, they're earning a percentage of that interest on the money that you're putting into their accounts. They're also earning a percentage of those interchange fees. And then with that revenue from the interchange fees and the interest, they can do stuff like loans or invest that money and get even better returns.
Yeah.
And then they could take portions of those returns and offer it as cash back incentives. And it becomes like a cyclical, business model to fund the actual business dealing.
And the nice thing about that too is that, with those fees, like they're making all of this, but that also means that they're able to, they give cash back and things to their customers and rewards and things. And so in some ways it's a win-win for the customer and the customer's getting money back
and the features of whatever app they built.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's the whole point of this is it's like micro increments over the traditional banking system. Mm-hmm. So like if you can have some like chat bot that helps you with your finances, what you've essentially done is made like an online only bank, then added this one feature. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, for a lot of people, like the younger side of the millennial generation and Gen Z, that's going to be banking.
Yeah.
It's like which app has that one feature that is most compatible with their lifestyle. That's probably going to be their bank, you know?
And I mean, nowadays too, I mean, with the nature of money, like I've been in the bank a couple of times and wondered if there was even, money in the vaults. Cause it's just all like, it's all digital. So it's just accounts moving back and forth. And so it's like, oh, got to go dig up the strong box out back to get that $5,000 withdrawal that you want. Like,
yeah, I feel like that huge like vault doors just, you know,
there's nothing behind it. It's just a brick wall. It's actually like a painting.
It's made out of wood. It's got like three small boxes of 100s to last the day. And then they order new cash, which I know there's some truth to that. But yeah, I mean, without becoming a finance podcast, the whole point here is like, I think there's two takeaways. One is that there's really not too many barriers to entry into a lot of these markets. Like 5 years ago, to say that like just a programmer who knows JavaScript could become a banking mogul was kind of crazy. But today, you know, if you're not like holding yourself back from opportunities and like being too passive to network and reach out and figure out what these opportunities are, you can definitely do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one kind of segues into that is, don't be too afraid to ask. So if you have an idea in a space that makes a lot of sense to you, it's almost getting to the point today where like, no matter how big that space or industry is, you can probably compete there. Someone's probably offering you a way in that's way, way easier. And even with Camber, you know, the guy told me about a program that didn't have a $3 to $5 million buy-in. And would, you know, like basically allow us to like use accounts for like virtual bill pay and still like play in that space without doing everything their API offered. And the only way I ever could have figured out that that existed was by calling him on my cell phone and having a conversation.
Yeah.
And the guy was super nice. He's from the like 2 hours away from the town where we're located here in the Midwest. And we just had a sweet conversation. It's not like the service is publicized at all. You know what I mean?
He said it wasn't even on the website either.
No, nothing. Their whole shebang was, but he's like, well, we also can offer you this because you're smaller. And just, I was like, listen, I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Just a programmer asking. So there you go.
Yeah.
A little gem of wisdom.
Yeah. For you. And I mean, I think that's a good point too, because I think a lot of times, you know, you hold yourself back because you're thinking, oh, well, you know, they won't want to answer all these questions. But a lot of times people are more than happy to talk with you, and, you know, people like being helpful, and, you know, there's a lot of opportunities out there. You just have to keep your eye open and be willing to reach out and ask questions. I mean, I think that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, no matter how large these two partner companies is, this idea of Camber, they have a lot of incentive to just field random questions like this, for the same reason that like I just called them randomly. I probably took up 3 minutes of this guy's time. Well, it's probably like 15, but we had a very quick phone call, and now I'm talking about it on a podcast. And someone who's listening to this podcast may know a buddy who has $3 to $5 million in seed investment in a fintech startup. Like, you never know. So for that guy to just spend a few minutes to tell me about it, he was way more than willing to do that.
Yeah.
And he kind of went above and beyond, even saying like, you know, let me know and email me your ideas and let me know what you think. And like, knowing, I was like, I don't have $3 to $5 million just to head this off. Yeah. It's, don't be shy like that. I mean, networking is a huge deal, and you don't have to go to like mixers and, you know, be giving like keynote presentations. Just pick up the phone and call some of these organizations that are doing things that you're interested in doing. More often than not, they'll point you in the right direction.
Yeah.
Even something as big as starting your own online bank.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of mediums of communication now too. So, I mean, phone calls, emails, it all works.
Yeah, definitely. Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, that's really all I had in that topic.
Yeah. I think it's a good thing to keep in mind. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of other opportunities in other industries as well. You just have to keep your eyes open and your ear to the ground.
Yeah. So. I'm starting a hospital next week.
Now, I don't know about that one. That'd be an interesting to see if healthcare.
You didn't see that diagnosis API? No, I'm just kidding.
Healing
2.0.
Oh.
All right, guys. Yeah. Well, I'm gonna do the call to action this time.
Okay.
I'm going to try to do it as good a justice as Brandon does. But guys, if you would please. No, seriously, though, we really enjoy doing this, and we do it whether anyone listened or not. But if you guys do and are willing to share it with others, that would just be icing on the cake. So if you like what you hear, subscribe, send us a message. We're at Code Review Pod on all the social networks. So it's pretty easy for you guys. Make sure you check out our website and just, you know, I don't know. Okay, it makes us feel good when Google Analytics shows a few more hits. So do that for no reason. But we'll talk to you guys next week. Anything to add, Brandon?
No, I think that's it. Thank you, guys.
Awesome. See ya.